Session number 27341, Reel 8.
John Maybank, Reel 8.
Yes, well, we got back from Okinawa to Sydney in early June, and we went to Schofields in Sydney, which is an RN airfield, and we did a bit of local flying there and various other activities, took some leave, but we were still based at Schofield, so we just went ashore, as it were, and had food and restaurants and, you know, did the pubs and things. And then the flying that we were doing, I've got recorded that we did some local flying, flight drill and flight aerobatics, quarter attacks with camera, Schofield to Victorious on the 26th of June, to fly, to go out and to start the Japanese operation. And then we did more flying off Victorious in June and in July. And we went to Manus on the way up there. On July the 4th, we arrived at Manus, and the Americans, Independence Day, they gave us a party, and it was a marvelous party. Lots and lots of beer, lots and lots of beautiful white bread and chickens, and so we had a nice party with the Americans. And then we left there and went on up to, and it was on the way up to Japan that we had a visit from Admiral Vian, who was the admiral in charge of the carrier force. And he came on board and he said, now you won't know where you're going, but you shouldn't know anyway, but it's now my duty to tell you that you're going to attack Japanese airfield in defense, in company with the American fleet. And it's a great honor for us to be part of this. Well, it's a wonderful opportunity for the fleet to distinguish itself. And you can expect 70% losses. Well, I couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe the bloody fool would ever say such a thing. I'm sorry to use that expression, but anyway, he went down in my estimation as a somewhat thick admiral who wasn't very clever at motivating aircrew. So we got up to Japan, and we didn't take too much notice of him, but it was a frightener to learn that we might be going in for that sort of loss situation. So, and then we did. I noticed in the logbook that we did a couple of in July, early July. The second, I did some radar calibration exercises and some interceptions for the fleet of low flying interceptions, I suppose, for radar purposes. And then submarine air patrol, combat air patrol, on the 17th of July. And on the 24th of July, we had our first strike, which was split owing to extremely bad cloud conditions, and we had to turn back and return, and that was the first exercise over Japan. And then we did some bombing over the inland sea area that was some towns or some cities. And we had to bomb through cloud. It was 10-tenths cloud up to 5,000 feet, to 15,000 feet, sorry. So we just couldn't, we just bombed through the cloud the CO must have worked out where he was, more or less, and he said, well, let him go here. And so we all let him go there, wherever there was. And then we did a bombing attack on a town called Nishima, N-I-S-H-I-M-A, the harbour and town, and started a few fires, and we strafed three small luggers I've got here.
What were the targets mainly when you were attacking the town? Was there anything specific there?
Radar positions that were on the hills near the town, really, rather than the town itself. But shipping harbour installations were in this town, and that's what they were going for, because they were trying to stop any shipping coming into ports to feed the communities and to...
Is there any difference in attacking a ship rather than attacking an airfield, or would you take the same kind of approach to it?
No, we just flew over and dropped the bombs. It was just like that. Bombs away, boys, and dropped the bombs. It was pretty casual. It wasn't at all what I would call efficient. A sort of pattern bombing. We didn't get in line astern and go over the harbour installation. We went over to buy and drop your bombs there. So we dropped our bombs. He worked out where he was and what he wanted to do. But we could see the bombs going down, and we could see they were going into the harbour area. But they were going all over the place. They weren't being directed at any one ship or one particular harbour. It was just the whole general area. We made a bit of a mess of it.
Was there a wealth of targets in the harbour area, really?
Were there a lot of targets? There were shipping. It was mainly coastal shipping. And, of course, the whole of Japan was fed by this means or by rail. And in some of these coastal villages and townships, there was no rail.
Did you attack railways at all?
Yes, a lot. Yes. We did a lot of strafing of rail installation. And let me see.
Can I just ask with the railway, what targets would you attack on the railway? Would it be...
I've got here a Straff passenger train near Koriyama. Another one, Comet Evertron, BPN. No enemy activity for us. The war is over.
Would you attack tunnels at all on the railway? Attack tunnels at all?
Tunnels. I didn't, but yes, we did. Yes, there was quite a lot of tunnels bombing done. In fact, the majority of it was effective on tunnels. It stopped. You couldn't always find trains. They might have been in the tunnels, but you certainly could find the tunnel, and you could drop a bomb on the tunnel quite easily. Because you could just fly along and just let your bomb go, and you just kept flying along, and it went up the tunnel. That, I know, that happened a lot, and the people got a lot of satisfaction over it. We were a ramrod, which is again a sort of strike, northwest Japanese coast, bomb near Shima Harbour. It was a fairly concentrated, and I only did 23 hours again in July, of strikes and combat air patrols, submarine combat air patrols, and what have you. And then the war was over. So, 23 hours. I did 91 hours, I think it was, altogether of combat flying, which... out of 400 and odd was pretty extensive, really. And all of it, in my opinion, was done without adequate training. But that was common in those days. I mean, I wasn't special. We weren't given sufficient instruction on any aspect of flying or fighting from an aircraft. And I've thought about it often, and I always thought, well, half the lack of confidence one must have felt in those days was due to an inadequacy in the training. I mean, for example, this business of photography. I had never known the first thing about photographing enemy installations of any kind, and never been taught the first thing about it. And then to be going into combat for the first time with a camera and be told to take photographs, I didn't know what I was supposed to do.
Would it have helped to have had more input from people who'd experienced combat?
Well, there's nobody on board that ship that had experienced combat. I think some of the pilots, I think Tritton had, but he was a non-speaker. He didn't talk to anybody. He was Commander Tritton, Lieutenant Commander Tritton, DSC and two bars. I think he probably got his second bar on our operation. He did Palembang. But he was a non-speaking CO. He never talked to anybody. This is the only time I ever remember talking to him was when I went to ask him, did I have to leave the ship? Because I'd prefer to stay on Illustrious than going to Victorious. He said, no, sorry, John, you're on your way. All right, boss, thanks very much. And off I went. And he never gave any instructions. No one ever in the whole time I was on board either ship came and talked to us at all about operations.
Would it have been useful?
It might have been reassuring. It might have told us what we were doing was all right or all wrong, or it would have been easier for us had we'd been told that we'll try something else out today, or we'll have a go at another. Has anybody got any ideas about this? Do you feel we're doing it the right way? Because a lot of it was experimental. I didn't like this diving down business. I thought it much better to come in low over the sea, go over the target, and away. They didn't see any sense in that because there was no... you're coming onto an island, they're going to spot you coming in anyway quite early on and could have put up a barrage you had to fly through. They thought it might be better to come down from 9,000 feet. Well, we didn't lose many that way. I can't say that those days were very instructive. We were learning as we went along, and at the end of the piece, I suppose we became quite acclimatized to the battle scene. But I fear that we were all more and more frightened as we went because it became hairier. It didn't become less hairy, it became worse. I think the stress was beginning to show at the end because I'd lost about a stone of weight and we were drinking too much. And nobody stopped us from drinking. And my mess bill was pretty high come the end of each month. With gin at tuppence, you had to drink an awful lot to spend a pound.
Was the squadron getting replacements for pilots lost in?
We got quite a lot of replacements at the end on 80. That squadron picture I showed you there was only half a squadron. That was after the end of Okinawa and before we went up to Japan. When we went up to Japan, the squadron had doubled in size.
And what about your commanding officer?
Yes, Bash Baldwin.
What was he like as a...
He was a friendly lad. He wasn't a bad lad at all. He was quite friendly. But it was extraordinary. I think he must have been just as frightened as we were because he never talked. He never came down to say, now look, let's gather around and have a chat about what's been going on. There was nothing like that.
Would that have been appreciated?
I think so. I think the RAF did it. The RAF tend to brief people, debrief people, and talk about their operations far more than we did.
Was that, do you think, some element of that almost a hangover from the old-fashioned fleet era, where I know there was...
Possibly.
Very, very different relations between air crew and people like the telegraphist air gunners who never received any briefings from.
Well, they were an unfortunate crowd, really, in that sense. I think that was disgusting the way they were treated. They should never have been treated in that fashion. Also, I don't see why they had to make a differential because of rank. It was just ridiculous.
Obviously, with the expansion of the fleet air arm as well, there was quite a diversity of backgrounds amongst the squadron, weren't there?
There was. You see, we were mainly RNVR, whereas the Royal Navy was hardly in appearance over there. I mean, Tritton was our NVR. He was a very senior pilot. He'd been around for yonks. He got his DSC, and he was one of these lads who was in the Mediterranean early on. And he got one DSC flying out of Malta doing flight reconnaissance stuff. And you know, he went back years, but I'm quite sure he was. He shouldn't have been there, I don't think. He should have been rested. That was the problem. We didn't have Cork, Dickie Cork. He was another Hayes chap. He, like Hayes, he'd been a Battle of Britain man. And, excuse me, I must go and spend a pen.
How did you hear of the atomic bombs dropping on?
Well, we had a, what they call SISDIC officer. He was RAF. He was a chap who was in our mess, but he was a Japanese-speaking intelligence officer who was listening into Japanese radio through the ship's radio system. And he told us in the wardroom, he said, well, you know, the Japanese, in fact, before the bomb, are suing for peace. And but we didn't take too much notice. And then when the bomb was dropped, he said, well, they're making big noises about peace. There's a big meeting on in Geneva. And then nothing happened. And they dropped the second bomb. And then he said they quit. And, of course, we went on flying. At least I didn't, but somebody was being flying. And I said to somebody in front of the notice board one day, God, it's bloody murder. These poor people are all going off shooting down these Japs or shooting at the Japanese, and they're being shot back. It's a bit murderous, isn't it? And a voice behind me was Commander Flying. Now, that's bloody mutiny. I said, no, it's not. I didn't refuse to do anything. I was just commenting on this. Well, I didn't like that man. Anyway, he didn't say any more than that. But that was the opinion one had, that we knew that people were in trouble if they were shot down, and it wasn't a very friendly place, Japan. And so, because of the lack of fleet train facilities, the fleet had to break up. And we were sent back early because we'd been doing it a long time. And so we went off to Sydney about a day or 2 days before the war actually ended. It didn't mean very much. Nothing much happened in those 2 days. I think one or two people may have lost their lives, but it was pretty small numbers.
How did everybody feel?
Fairly euphoric when the war was over, yes, euphoric. And certainly we relaxed, and we were put on watch duties then. We had to go on the bridge and take watch duties then, because there was no flying. They didn't want us to fly. So we'd finished our flying. So they made us do watch duties. So several drunken fleet Aram officers were on watch drinking Kai, which was this cocoa drink with rum in it. And it was great fun. Anyway, we got back to Sydney, and when I got back, I applied for home leave and went to see the captain about home leave. And he said, what do you want to go home for? I said, well, I've had enough war. I want to go home. I said, I think it would be very helpful if I did. I said, I don't know what's wrong with you young fellas. I said, you miserable old bugger. Which reminded me, talking, the day we got on board Victorious, and we'd been flying off Illustrious for some weeks. We were 13 of us, and the captain marshalled us in his day cabin and then lectured us. This is Captain Denny, of great fame. He became a rear admiral soon after the battle ended. He lectured us on landing corsairs on his carrier and told us he didn't want us pranging all over his ship. You know, you have to bring your aircraft in on a gliding turn. And here we'd been flying off this other carrier. I mean, it was just ridiculous. Anyway, we sort of took this on board with some reluctance and thought, God, we joined the nanny navy. But he was the only words of advice that we ever got in the Navy. Really, it was quite hopeless. Nobody really wanted to know. They were all either fighting a ship or fighting or in an aeroplane. And I think everybody had to live his own war. I think the RAF were much more concerned, I think, with training and utilising the activities of operations to try and give their air crew some support and advice, but we didn't get any.
But Captain Denny didn't really want you to leave at the end?
No, but that was rather funny. He'd gone. It was another man called McIntosh, I think his name was, but it didn't matter because there was a Admiralty Fleet order which said the following officers will go on New Zealand leave immediately. Nash, Maybank, Jamieson, the three of us went off. And we three had been three who'd been on KG5 up on the AGN. And so we went off home, and I got home 3 weeks after the war was over, and I was a bit of a wreck by then. I'd lost weight, and I was drinking a bit too much, and my father and mother said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. And of course, the New Zealand government sent me no advice that about university courses, which I could have attended. I could have gone to university, which I might have done. In a few months after I arrived home, they had these things working and operating because a lot more men were coming back, but I must have been amongst the very first back after the war. And the army certainly was still away in Europe, because the army had fought its way right through Egypt and then Italy and right up to the Yugoslav border. And Trieste, I think most of them were in at that stage. Anyway, having met an army friend of father's, this fellow called McCulloch, he suggested that maybe I'd like to join the army. And I thought, well, what a good idea. He said, well, you can go out to J-Force. He said, it'll give you a break and give you a chance to sort of catch your breath.
Had you been demobilised at that stage?
Yes, only just. I was at home from September to October, and it must have been pretty early in September, probably within the first week of September that I got home, and I think my pay ended in December. Then I got blood money, prize money, about 400 quid, and I had been saving money through the war because they retained some of your wages. So there's another 400 quid there. So I was a wealthy young man, so I blew most of it on a high life of enjoying myself. And having a look around, you know, the area and getting to know people. And then I went into the army. And they gave me a commission, second lieutenant. Well, having been a sub-lieutenant, it didn't make much difference. You were still the lowest of the low. And I went off to camp, and I did quite a lot of training, both in two camps, one at Burnham in the South Island and then up to Trentham in the North Island. And then I think it was in June 46, I took a draft of men to Japan. These were all recruits who'd joined J-Force had their initial training, and I took them up there, and 90% of them were sick, and because of my naval training and being at sea, I didn't get seasick. So I found that I was not just the officer in charge, I was also in charge of this of the quarters and the bogs and the heads, if you like to call them, the heads, and I found I was cleaning their heads out most of the time because they were so full of vomit, and the poor men, they were really in a bad way, and they were sleeping in hammocks, and a lot of them didn't know how to, so I had to train them how to sleep in hammocks, and I had to help to clean the muck up, and it didn't do me any harm from the point of view of starting to realise that, you know, the other human beings on the planet had to be looked after. And got to Japan, and when I got there, I was a platoon commander of a platoon that was based away from the battalion, looking after a town called Bofu. And I was in a place called Yamaguchi. The battalion was at Yamaguchi in southern Honshu.
What was the battalion you were with?
27th New Zealand Machine Gun Battalion, which was infantry then because they didn't have enough machine guns. And I took over this platoon in Bofu, and as a deployed unit, I was in charge of the town. And I had to inspect brothels and things like that to make sure the New Zealanders weren't catching the clap or being naughty boys. And I had to look out for Koreans who might be coming in by sea, because we were on the coast, and we had to prevent the landing of any people who shouldn't have been migrating to Japan. The Koreans were starving. They were in a bad way. And the Japanese weren't much better off, but at least they were hard, busy at farming. And then I seemingly did a good job at this, and so they promoted me to lieutenant, and quite quickly thereafter to captain.
Can I ask, with the town, in the town above, did you have any contacts with the Japanese civilian administration?
And strangely enough, later I went back as a company commander with 100-odd blokes. And the same applied in both instances. I knew the mayor, the chief of police, the chief of public safety, the governor, and there was a prince of the royal family who lived on a hill and with whom I was friendly, and I used to go and visit him, and he had a marvellous record collection and four record playing players which worked in concert, which had been given him by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation before the war. And you could play a symphony by putting side one, side two, side three, side four, you know. And then when you've got those four done, you get five, six, seven, and eight, you see, by turning them over. So one and five were the same record. And this is how you got a symphony without a break, because you got them all in tune, in coordinated with special equipment. And we used to go and play classical music. Well, he used to play as classical music. And the only other man he invited was the wing commander in charge of the Royal Australian Air Force Mustang Squadron, who was down there, who became a friend of mine. So here was a second lieutenant, but I wore wings, and I had battle medals and what have you. And so he recognized a kindred spirit. But, you know, it's rather strange reflecting on it. He had a DSC, this fellow. As soon as in the RAF people got promoted, they got a gong. They usually got promoted a couple of times even. You know, got a gong, you're on your way to stardom. In the Navy, you didn't. A friend of mine got two DSCs, and he was still a sub-lieutenant, and he ended the war, and he's retired as sub-lieutenant ARNZNVR, DSC and BAR. And he'd been a squadron commander, but he was still a sub-lieutenant. But that's the Navy. But going back to Japan, we had the duty of care for the Japanese, so the police would report any unlawful activities, murders and things like that. And we had to sort of try and help them with our resources, such as they were, to keep the peace and keep the sort of public happy with their lot. And that meant making sure that the place was kept clean and tidy. And they were very keen that, to play a part in looking after their area with our help.